Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland.
Hello, and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. This is episode 22, where we'll be speaking to Douglas Spears, the archaeologist, about more fascinating info to do with the witch trials and specifically Lilias Aidy's case in Fife.
Yes, Zoe, I'm really looking forward to hearing more from Doug Spears about Lilias's trial. We've got a lot coming up in relation to the actual detail of her trial, and he goes into fantastic detail about the allegations against Lilias. But before that, just want to say that I'm absolutely delighted that there are so many people that have already signed the petition. And in fact, that we've got worldwide support for it. As we've said before, the majority of people signing the petition are Scottish, but there is also interest from Canada, America, Australia, Belgium, Germany. And it's just great to see so many people from across the world being interested in the idea of the people of Scotland getting an apology for what happened in the past. So I'm delighted about that. There's also, I don't know if you saw, Zoe, there's a bit at the bottom of the petition where people are able to add their comments.
Yeah, they're fascinating, actually, the comments.
Yeah.
Quite a range of different reasons people are giving for why they think it's a good idea, sort of ranging from, you know, this is a historical wrong that needs to be reckoned with, you know, like we would often say to people who are respectful of people, practitioners in nature, you know, who may or may not call themselves witches, but who definitely think that that's an issue that needs to be looked at. To people saying that, you know, we need to sort things out before we can move forward positively in our country. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm so pleased to see that people, for the very most part, have the same idea as us, that this is a terrible injustice and something has to be done. We had someone suggesting, and I think we've put links to it on Twitter, that the idea was a joke and a waste of time. But thankfully, I was very, very pleased to see the response to that. And I think the emphatic response was that people do not think it's a joke or a waste of time at all for the Justice Committee to be thinking of this.
Yeah, I mean, it is a serious thing. And I think it really is worth saying, I think that most of our listeners are definitely on board with this. But if you're new to listening to the podcast and you're not entirely sure what the relevance of this is when it happened hundreds of years ago, the relevance is that it was a terrible thing that happened. And even if it was hundreds of years ago, we feel it's really important to say, right, this is part of Scotland's history. We're not trying to rewrite history. We're not trying to say it didn't happen. We're not doing it just to look cool to people on Twitter, but we're doing it because we think it's really important that we recognise that as part of our past so we don't make similar mistakes again. And we know with very, very recent history that bad things can happen even in the contemporary day. And I think it's really important that we just recognise the fact that we don't ever want to get into a position again where there's a kind of a, you know, a rolling ball of horror where people get sucked into getting, you know, involved in a situation that really goes against people's rights and their dignity. And I just think it's really important that we recognise that so we can say, right, this happened. We're not like that anymore and move forward. In the same way that there have been apologies and pardons for members of our community who were hassled and ostracized and charged because they were gay. You know, like we recognize now that that was a terrible thing that happened. And nobody would say, well, you know, it was 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. You wouldn't say that, you know, you would just say it was something that was wrong and we need to just recognize that and move on. Or with the more recent issue of the minors that Claire's talked about in the past, you know, that we've looked at in Scotland as well. So we just think it's important that we recognise it. And I think sometimes people, the very few people that be negative about it, are showing a bit of ignorance, really, in some ways as well, that they don't really understand what happened in the past. I think as soon as you start to understand that people were accused by anybody, that there wasn't actually proper evidence, that people were tortured with sleep deprivation or other things, as we're going to be talking about in a little bit, it was a bad thing, you know. And it's okay to say, right, there was a bad thing in our past. And, you know, I think it's important that it's marked with a memorial so that we see that and we know the importance of memorials in public life.
100% agree, Zoe. There was also very timeless article about Mary Beard saying that the term witch was used against her and against older people in order to devalue, discredit, disregard what they were saying. And again, we tweeted out that article to lots and lots of responses as well, lots of people that it resonated with, that older women found themselves being called a witch and being disregarded in this way. And again, it's like the thing that I've made to say to myself not to say the phrase old wives' tales as something which dismisses women. But in fact, if I ever use the term old wives' tale, I will mean it as in, you better take some good cognizance of that, because there were some women that knew what they were talking about, those old
wives. I think as well, one other criticism that we had from somebody, which we've talked about on Twitter, so you can go back and have a look at that and see how that kind of played out. But one comment we had was that they'd like to, you know, if we're going back as far as the witches, let's go further back and let's take the Romans to court. Well, let's take the Italians to court so they can apologise for the Roman invasion, or talk to our Scandinavian cousins about the Vikings and look for an apology from them. I mean, said half as a joke, but also half seriously, you know, like this idea about, well, you know, if you're going to go that far back, let's go further. You know, you're always, there's a sort of an accusation of, you know, you're always looking these days for somebody to say sorry for you, kind of grow up a wee bit. I don't think you can really compare sort of war type situations, whereas other nations that attacked us, or indeed where Scotland attacked other nations, as we were terribly good at as well. I think this is a different thing, because it was something done in Scotland by the Scots. It was state sanctioned. And that's why we think it's important that the state apologises and issues a pardon and makes a memorial. We think it's very important that we own this terrible thing that happened.
History does not have a time limit. And
exactly.
It is justice. And we just want to get justice insofar as we can for those that were killed as witches.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of those that were killed as witches.
Yes, Claire.
That was almost my first professional segue here. So
it was. And then you commented on it and you spoiled it.
Sorry.
Carry on.
Sorry, everyone.
Speaking of witches, Claire, yes.
Speaking of witches, we will, before we start speaking to Doug today, tell you about three different people who were accused as witches. I'm going to speak about the first person. Just want to remind everyone that we're using the online resource, the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft, which we would really commend you to go and look at. It's a fantastic resource and allows you to look up different aspects of cases, allows you to look up different types of accusations, different areas that people were killed. So it's one of the really, really good tools online for doing this sort of research. So we thought we would look this week about women who were accused of witchcraft with one thing in common, and that was that part of the accusation related to issues of property and finance. So there was some underlying issue about money or land that really was the basis for these witchcraft allegations. We've spoken in the past about various other ulterior motives, but these today are based in property. The first person is Gormal Grant. The name Gormal spelled G-O-R-M-Y-L, Gormal Grant. I was minded that we've spoken about a story about a person accused of witchcraft before called Gormal, and I wondered if that was the same name. This case of Gormal Grant is recorded as being complicated. Essentially, a number of people from the MacLean family were accused by a family called the Chisholms. It's recorded that there might have been some family rivalry between the MacLean and the Chisholms, and in particular that the Chisholms wanted to acquire the lands belonging to the Macleans. It is recorded that the Macleans had been, inverted commas, kindly tenants, close inverted commas, for several hundred years. So what better way, Zoe, to get someone off their land than to make allegations of witchcraft? And that's what happened. The Chisholms made allegations of witchcraft against Gorimal Grant, who was a member of the Maclean family. The trial of Gorimal took place in 1662, and Gorimal was subject to torture. Records show that Gorimal was sleep-deprived, bound with ropes, whipped, had their feet burnt, and were subject to hanging by thumbs. A complaint was made about the torture of Gorimal by one of the Maclean family, and the local investigators were ordered to bring the accused to Edinburgh after Maclean complained about the illegal imprisonment and torture. The person who brought the claim of torture and flagged it up with the Privy Council in Edinburgh was Sir Rory Maclean of Duart. And in the survey, he is described as a rescuer of Gorimal Grant because he'd flagged up the fact that this person was being tortured. After a petition was lodged flagging up this and asking that the torture be stopped, a counter petition was lodged by those on behalf of the Macleans. And it was about the cost of having to transport the accused and said that the trial should take place locally. And all we know about this further is that the charges against the Chisholms about torture were dropped. But that may have been, Zoe, because they'd flagged it up with the Privy Council that was against torture, it may be that claim was dropped because the torture had by then stopped. Unfortunately, we do not know the outcome of the case against Gorimal Grant, so we do not know what happened after the terrible accusation of witchcraft and the torture which she endured. And unfortunately, we simply do not know the outcome of the case.
The next person we're going to look at is Catherine Ross. Now, her trial date was the 22nd of July, 1590, in Edinburgh. And it says here that she had defence. Now, this is interesting. Her stepson, Hector, wanted her terse, her third, presumably, of her estate or land. It was said that, and this sounds comical, but obviously isn't, but it was said that she made a picture of her victim out of butter. Suppose you have to work with whatever materials you've got to hand. And then she fled to Caithness when all her accomplices were tried and convicted. But she was then tried and acquitted. But unfortunately, we don't have any further information about that to shed any light on what on earth happened. Then we've got a lady called Helen Muirhead. The case against Helen Muirhead was started on the 4th of April 1659 and ended the next day on the 5th. There was a dispute again over her terse, which we think this might be an old word for inheritance. She wanted the life rent of her dead husband's land and the half mark of her brother-in-law. And in fact, it was her brother who accused her of witchcraft, which is just absolutely bananas. She was accused of causing harm to a man who had gotten her sister pregnant and then married another. So it's quite a complex family story there. The brother accuses her, and part of the accusation is that she was sort of defending the honour of her pregnant and then sort of duped sister, which is interesting. So it says here the trial date was on the 4th of April. It was at the toll booth. The place of trial was in Dumfries. She was found guilty. She was sentenced to execution. She pled not guilty. She may have been tried earlier under a commission from the Committee of Estates, but we know that she was definitely tried at the circuit court, that she was executed by strangulation and then her body was burnt. It's just really horrible. So it said, there says here also that there's post-trial notes that says between 2 to 4 in the ordinary place, sentenced on the 5th of April, 1649, to be executed the next Wednesday. So I don't know, Claire, does the ordinary place, does that refer to the place of execution or the place of trial?
The ordinary place is the place of execution. So there would be an ordained place that people would be executed. And that is where they're talking about. Just historically, interestingly, in Scotland, when people died in inheritance, things were divided up into a third to the children, a third to the spouse, third elsewhere. A division of thirds was common. And when I looked up the word terse, someone wanted her terse, I looked up the word terse And terse means a third of something. Mm-hmm. So wanted her third, was wanting right. her inheritance, wanting her part of what she was due to inherit. So I think that's what's meant by wanting her terse. And the other thing about these sad stories is that whilst these people were convicted of witchcraft, the underlying rationale about all of them were really about something completely different, about interpersonal relationships and about finances. And these poor women that we remember, Gormal Grant, Catherine Ross and Helen Moorhead, we remember them as people who were accused as witches, but who were not witches.
We're delighted to be joined again today by Douglas Spears, archaeologist for Fife and Dundee, where we're going to be talking more about the awful case of Lilias AD in Cúras in Fife. Doug, welcome back to the show again.
Good morning, Zoe.
Good morning. Hello. So last time, Claire, where had we gotten up to with the story of Lilias?
So when we last spoke to Doug, we had heard about the town that Lilias lived in, her neighbours, the accusations made against her, and we had just got to the point where Lilias had been arrested for a second time. Unlike the first allegation, the second allegation stuck. And Doug, perhaps if you can tell us, from the second allegation that was made against her, what happened to Lilias?
Well, this is where we start to get some detail, because the Kirk Session minutes for Torryburn are very detailed about what happened next and what happened over the next 4 weeks, sadly the last 4 weeks of poor Lilias's life. So we know that on the night of the 29th of July, she was taken into custody at 10 o'clock at night. That's all we know. Taken into jail, stored in, when I say jail, taken into custody and locked in a strong room in Torryburn Parish Church. And the very next day, so this is the 30th of July, she spent one night in custody and she's interrogated for the first time. And the minute records that Lilias, being exhorted to declare the truth and nothing but the truth, she replied, "What I am to say shall be this, as true as the sun is in the firmament." So the minutes say this is a really good, clear kind of, listen to this, everybody, because I'm going to spill the beans and it's completely and utterly true. Which immediately makes you think, these minutes have been faked. Who says that when you're panicking and frightening and in custody? But they continue to record events. And I'll actually just read a tiny bit just to give you some flavour of it. It says, being interrogated, if she was in compact with the devil, she replied, "I am in compact with the devil, and I have been so since before the second burning of the witches in this place." And that's a reference to a previous burning of witches in 1666. She further declared that the first time she met with the devil was at the Gollet, which is a small local river, between Torryburn and Newmills in the harvest time before the sunset, where she trysted to meet the day after, which tryst she kept. And the devil took her to a stook side and caused her renounced her baptism. The ceremony he used was this. He put one hand on the crown of her head and the other on the soles of her feet and caused her say, "All was the devil's betwixt the crown of her head and the soles of her feet. And there the devil lay with her carnally, and that his skin was cold and his colour was black and pale. And he had a hat on his head and his feet were cloven like the feet of a stirk." And a stirk's a young bullock kept for meat. So basically, on the very first day, 9 o'clock, the night after being taken into custody, Lilias is interrogated, and apparently those are the first words out of her mouth. Now, I'm not terribly convinced by the fact that these are her words, but certainly that's what the minister in the Kirk Session recorded as a minute of her very first trial and response.
And Doug, was it said that prior to her saying this, there had been any form of, was it noted that there was any form of discussion or sleep deprivation or anything? Do we know anything about that?
Well, this is the bizarre thing about this incredible confession. She was taken into custody at 10 o'clock the night before. She was interrogated the next day, and I'm quite sure she was panicked, worried, frightened, all sorts of things. These were terrible things to happen to an elderly, lonely, vulnerable woman. So she must have been in an extremely distressed state. But she can't have been exposed to too much because she was only incarcerated for one night. And that these are apparently the very first words she came out with. And of course, what we see there is a very clear black and white confession of evil and evil doings with the devil. She, it would appear, with almost no prompting, confessed that she was a witch. She had been since before 1666. She'd renounced her Christian baptism and she had lay carnally and had sex with the devil. And she had willingly entered into an evil satanic baptism, renouncing her own baptism. And of course, the key thing about Christian baptism is essentially an inoculation against evil. So you couldn't get more bad than this. She had willingly renounced her baptism and had become an agent of Satan. And they were the very first words out of her mouth. Now, of course, Elise knew, or would anybody would have known fine well at this period, what happens when you confess to witchcraft? Certain death at this period. So it seems very suspicious that somebody would make such a self-condemning confession on the first morning.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, when people, I think I've mentioned this before in the podcast, people are fascinated, and as I am, with the fact that people will confess to things that they haven't done. Even in the modern day, where there aren't such threats about them, or there's supposed to be all sorts of procedural safeguards in place to make people not feel under pressure, either the fear of physical injury or even the psychological pressure of being in a police station or something like that. We try to protect against that. And time again, we see people confessing to things that they haven't done through psychological pressure. Now, I suppose there's two possibilities with Lilith, which is she either did make some form of confession because she was so terrified that she didn't want the torture to happen that was going to happen to her. So she very quickly confessed to avoid the torture, a sort of avoiding the short-term terror, but building into that the long-term terror of her eventual death, or it is just made up. Which is, again, unfortunately, something that can happen with confession evidence.
These are really good points, but my own feeling is, and I completely get the point that, and psychologists and others have proven it so many times, that people can, under intense interrogation, be convinced that they've done something that they haven't done, and then they will willingly confess to something because they genuinely believe they've done it, even though they haven't done. But I think in this case, she's only been incarcerated for one night. This is the next morning she is being interrogated. And for me, what makes this complete nonsense in terms of a realistic account of events is if we actually unpack what she said there, she gives a very clear declaration that her evidence is true and factual. You know, she says, as true as the sun is in the firmament and so on. So first of all, that makes you think, right, that's an open, everything I say hereafter is the absolute God's honest truth. And then she gives an absolute cast iron clear admission of guilt. She goes into detail about laying with the devil and renouncing her baptism. She then talks or mentions about the confession of a long history of guilt. She doesn't say, I just started this last week and big boys made me do it. You know, she confesses to having been a witch before 1666. And this is 1704, so what, if somebody else can do the sums, but you know, this is 30 years or so. And she renounces her Christian baptism. Now, today, we are not terribly worried about that, but in this period when baptism was so fundamentally important as a rite of admission into the church, and it was a prerequisite of entry into heaven and so on, this was really, really, really important. You couldn't get a bigger deal than confessing to having renounced your baptism in favour of a satanic baptism. And of course, then to add to rubbish her character and as a woman and as a person, she gives details of sealing that compact by having sex, fornication at a stookside in a field with the devil, and describes his black swarthy skin, his cloven, you know, beast-like hoofs and so on and everything else. I mean, goodness, in a tiny little statement, she managed to absolutely condemn herself beyond any question. Now, are these really the words of a peasant or elderly woman in a small, tiny little backwater little parish in Fife in 1704? I would say what we're seeing here is complete fabrication of the minutes. And what makes me even more utterly convinced of this, as if we needed more evidence, is that those details she gives of her renunciation of her baptism and her admission into the satanic cult, when she has sex with the devil and then he puts his hand on her head and hand below her feet and says everything in between is mine. Well, crazily enough, when we study as historians the records of witchcraft in Fife, we find that in 1649 that Margaret Martin in Inverkeithing confessed exactly the same thing. Now, is it likely that, again, 55 years before, somebody would have used almost exactly the same words, that the devil put his hand on my head, the feet underneath, he caused me to renounce it? So this is a word-for-word copy. Now, we can conclude either two things. The devil is real, and he was operating in West Fife in the 17th century, having sex with women and forcing them to renounce their baptism, or that we have an institution, in this case the church, which has basically got a preconceived idea of what guilt is and is forcing it on those that it considers guilty.
I think for Zoe and I, we're giving the former proposition a strong no. I think we're definitely thinking the devil was not amongst the women of Scotland at that time. That's fascinating that you say it's almost a word-for-word confession similarity. One of the famous Scottish cases in recent history that's a miscarriage of justice was about people giving confessions and saying the exact same thing and having noted the exact same thing. And part of that was the case of the Ice Cream Wars, which happened in Scotland. So Zoe and I are both very interested in true crime as well, and no doubt we can talk about that maybe in another forum, Zoe, about how people, if people confess to things, they all don't say the exact same words, because it's very unlikely that people express themselves in the exact same way. So that's fascinating. So we've got this first confession from her. Do we know who took the confession from her?
Yes, we've got a good record of who was actually there in terms of Reverend Alan Logan, the minister, was sitting in judgment as the kind of judge, and the Kirk Session are there, and they're all named, and the Bailey Williamson is the sort of court officer, whatever that individual office is called. You know, you give me the words here, the bouncer, the guy to keep everybody in order.
Court mason.
There we go. Thank you for that. But as if I needed to make the case any more clearly that this was a fixed record, when we really drill down into the minutes, we actually find that there are many entries in the minutes that describe events that don't happen until a week or a few days after the events. So clearly these minutes were written up after the event, all minutes are, but the fact that they include things for certain dates, references to events which didn't happen for another 2 weeks, gives us some kind of idea that these minutes weren't written up at the time as things were being said, or even the next day or that night. They can have been written up until 2-3 weeks afterwards in some cases. So this is clearly a record of what the court wanted recorded, and probably not nearly an accurate account of what actually happened. It's also very interesting that the dates don't match. So, for example, in the minutes, they say that Tuesday, the 28th of June, is given as a Tuesday. But when you actually consult the historical calendars on Google, you find out that that was a Friday. Now, is it likely that they wouldn't have known what day of the week it was in 1704? So, really, I think if Lilias had you clear on her case, it wouldn't be too hard to prove that this was a trumped-up charge, the accusations against her were false, and the record of her interrogation and trial was just complete nonsense.
That is such an interesting aspect of it. Do you think it is possible, Doug, that this was being done as a back-covering exercise because an old woman had died in their custody?
That's my view of things, because what we actually find is there are pages and pages and pages in the Torryburn Kirk Session minutes from mid-June 1704 to the 3rd of September 1704 about this case, and then suddenly overnight nothing more is mentioned. Now, during that four-week period, a suspected witch, Lilias, is incarcerated, interrogated, spills the beans on about another eight women, or three women at least. They then in turn start pointing the finger at other women, and witches are being have discovered everywhere. There's accusations and so on, and people are being glued. So from nowhere, a single accusation snowballs into this localised parish witch hunt within a month. Witches are absolutely everywhere. And then suddenly overnight, there's the case closes and there's no further record or mention of anything against anyone ever again. Now, how do we account for this? Well, my view, and it's only a personal view, it's not substantiated, I think two things have happened. I think one, they've got carried away. They've treated Lilia so badly, she's died in custody. And when the Kirk Session and the minister have approached the civil authorities and asked for a mandate, a legal commission to try the witches, the civil authorities have denied that and said, stop being so silly and torturing your poor old residents like this with trumped up ridiculous charges. And knowing that they couldn't get a proper legal-based trial through the informed kind of channels, they've just been told to pretty much drop the case. And I think that's probably what's happened. I also think we have to appreciate that Lilius's death was essentially an illegal killing, in the sense that there wasn't a legal mandate. There was a mandate and there were powers for the church to investigate this case and to take confessions and so on, but not actually to bring about a death without due and proper authority. And of course, poor Lilius died without due proper authority putting her to death.
Doug, I had thought, in fact, that Lilius didn't name anyone else. And it's very interesting for you to explain to us that, in fact, she did, but nothing happened. Presumably, the story that she didn't incriminate anyone was because nothing else happened. So people formed the view that had she named other people, we would know about those people as well, and they would be part of Lilius's story. But as you say, if the story is, want of a better phrase, if the story is killed because they don't want to take it any further, then those people that were accused, we simply no longer hear tell about. But she did incriminate others then. How many others?
Well, there was quite a number, because, of course, we saw that she was first interrogated the day after she got taken into custody. And then 2 days later, in fact, no, the next day later, on the 31st of July, she is interrogated again. So this is about her third day in custody. Now, she adhered to her original confession. And she offered more evidence of her guilt, and she talked about her attendance at local witch gatherings. And she stated that her last attendance at a witch gathering locally had been in August of 1701 at the minister's glebe. And how much insult of that is that, telling everybody that we actually had this satanic cabal meeting round the back of the minister's house. But at that interrogation event, as well as, interestingly, she called the devil a villain who promised her many good things, but when she engaged with him, he never gave her anything but misery and poverty. But the key things is, at that second interrogation, she accused local women, Agnes Curry and Elspeth Williamson, of being witches. So, of course, immediately they were hauled up in front of the Kirk Session, and then the spotlight was on them. The focus was still always on Lilius as the ringleader, but of course, when Lilius started to name other women, they got hauled up, and the case mushrooms, more people are called, more evidence than given, and everything's gets an awful lot more complicated.
Can I just ask, Doug, because you'd mentioned in the last time that we spoke to you, I think that the minister, Logan, was not an uneducated man. Like he was possibly a bit of an intellectual, I think, from what you'd said. So how does that sit with the falsification of reports?
Reverend Alan Logan was an incredible individual. He was a very erudite and learned man. He was very well published. He was a quite talented theologian. He was quite a strong influence in the church in this period. He was from minor landed aristocracy, more gentry. His father was Logan of Logan in Ayrshire, the estate, you know, of baronial status. So this guy, you know, he was a really important player. He married very well into the local landed minor aristocratic families in the area, the Colvilles and so on, of Cleish and of Curros. So this guy was no country bumpkin, but clearly what we're seeing, these didn't stand in the way of doing God's work in his eyes. And if that involved the falsification of evidence, which I would argue it manifestly and clearly did, then clearly he didn't have a problem with that. Because, of course, when you're doing God's work, sometimes you have to, you know, break a few eggs to make an omelette or whatever the saying is, you know, quite simply is he'd found evil in his parish and he wanted to root it out. And so falsifying a few records clearly wasn't something he had a problem with.
I wonder whether as well that if you were seen sort of like maybe nationally or seen in Edinburgh as being somebody who had found evil and, you know, dealt with it, that would raise your status as well, possibly, that you were seen as somebody that dealt with the evil.
Certainly amongst his peers within the church, they would have been great supporters of his. They would have been great admirers of this man going to these extreme lengths to root out evil and so on in Scotland and in his parish. So he would have had a huge support amongst the church. But I don't think at this period the secular authorities were not, they were moving fast away from the idea of local courts trying women as accused of witches on the most ridiculous of evidence. Now, just to completely contradict what I said a minute ago, it is interesting, actually, that after Reverend Alan Logan left Torryburn Parish as the minister there in 1715, he got moved up the road to Curross, where he continued up until the, till the late 1720s, early 1730s. Now, interestingly, there is a record of him writing back to his former parish of Torryburn and asking for the minutes of that case. Now, why did he want these minutes 10, 15, 20 years later? My feeling is he wanted to rewrite history and to get rid of that record for some reason. But again, we don't have enough evidence to be absolutely sure of this. But why else would a guy, a minister who'd left his charge in Torryburn, write back 15, 20 years later and say, give me the minutes of the witch trial case and tear them out of the Crux Session book and send them to me?
That actually gives me goosebumps. The idea that he realised, he knew, and if he was a man of learning, he would easily have been able to look at the minutes if someone else had written them up and thought, dear Lord, if anyone casts their eye over that, they're immediately going to be able to see they weren't written at the time. They might even be able to tell that they were somebody else's confession. And I want them to remain in my custody rather than being available for someone just to pick up. So you give them to me and the truth of my crime is not disclosed.
I think that's exactly, well, that's exactly the way I read it. And it just shows you that Reverend Logan was quite right, because some, however long it is, 300 years later, we've rumbled his game and exposed him for the kind of man he was. So, yes, and clearly the minutes were never taken out of the Crux Session book and sent to him, because, of course, we have a copy of them now and we can read them. So, yeah, I think basically towards the end of his life, he was trying to cover up things that might perhaps have stained his career or memory.
Or in fact, that he realised that these things might be looked at a later stage in history by someone such as yourself, Doug, and the truth was out.
It's entirely possible. He may have been conscious of his place in history and posterity and so on. I think he probably had more immediate concerns about people looking at them. Perhaps there were some events going on at that period of which we don't know or something like that. But something certainly jolted him to look into his past activities and try and cover that up. And certainly that sounds like a man with a very guilty conscience to me.
My mind has gone off to the made-for-TV show that somebody has got to write about this. Zoe, somebody has got to write a brilliant TV show, because it took place a long time ago, but its themes are as current as any in the present day.
So while Lilias was in custody, do we have any more documentation about her experience, or is it just down to these probably not very reliable court minutes?
These Crux Session minutes, they don't supply any detail, but we can infer an awful lot and we can reconstruct events. So, for example, the minutes don't actually tell us where Lilias was held, but we can be absolutely sure that it was in Torryburn Church and not in Curross or Dunfermline Tollbooth.
I saw something on Twitter this week about where supposedly Lilias was held, and it was in, now Claire, was it the town hall of Curross that
yes.
they seemed, that this person seemed to indicate that that's where they thought that Lilias was held, with an idea that she was held in the highest part of the building that was the furthest away from the devil.
But you're saying, based on absolutely on documentation, that there's no way that she was in Kooragh, she was in Torryburn.
I would say that's the case. Now, an awful lot of accused witches were held in the Tolbooth, the townhouse of Kooragh. That's the building, the seat of town government there. We know an awful lot of women were held there over the years in the 17th century. But why I don't think this was the case with Lilias is that she's quite often interrogated day after day, twice a day and so on. And that would involve the Kirk session and the minister traipsing a few miles along the road every other 5 minutes to interrogate her. And they're not going to do that over a period of a month. And secondly, there is a cost to keeping somebody in prison, incarcerating them. And Kooragh wouldn't want to absorb that cost for a local matter, which is a Torryburn issue. So I'm confident that Lilias was held in the parish church in Torryburn. And you asked about those conditions. Now, we don't know what those conditions are, but we can be pretty sure from the vast wealth of documentation that we have relating to similar cases that it would have been a pretty miserable experience. She would have been locked in a small, secure room. We can imagine that her food ration and so on would have been really, really terrible. She would have been subject to incredible intimidation and so on. She probably wasn't actively tortured in the traditional sense of torture, but she would have been watched and warned. She would have been subjected to sleep deprivation, which was a very, very common form of maltreatment. Now,
what was that phrase you said? Watched and
warned. Watch and warned. So she's watched to make sure she doesn't fall asleep, and she's warded, so she's actually incarcerated. So basically, they went out of the way to intimidate her, to be nasty to her, to give her poor food rations, to expose her to sleep deprivation. So every time she fell asleep, they would poke her with a stick or be nasty to her in some way to keep her awake and so on. So she would have been half out of her mind with sleep deprivation and torture. She would have been frightened. She was an elderly woman and so on. She talks in certain places about her eyesight is failing. And in some of her later confessions, as we'll see in a minute, she says that, you know, she would have gone to more local witch meetings, but her age and infirmity, prevented her from going every time there was a local meeting and so on. So we get a picture of a frail, elderly, weak, vulnerable woman treated absolutely terribly, kept in confinement and subject to sleep deprivation and so on. So this is a terrible, terrible picture that builds up, even though nowhere do they actually say how she was treated or kept or where. But we get glimpses when she talks about the faint light on the floor coming through the window. So clearly there was a window in the room in which she was kept. So we get snippets which allow us to build up a picture.
This gives the lie to this whole idea about them being witches, because surely if they were witches, and we've said some words along the lines of this before, if they were witches, they wouldn't get caught. If they were in league with the devil and the devil was as mighty and as strong as they say, then surely the devil would get them out of these jams. And if they had magical powers, why would their physical body being old and frail prevent them from getting to witches' meetings? Surely they would, fly there do you know what I mean? It just seems to go against all the idea of the power that the witches supposedly held, that actually, ultimately, they clearly don't have any power whatsoever. It's bizarre. It's so odd.
That's so true. But one of the sad things about the whole history of the treatment of witches is the ridiculous inconsistency of it all. And of course, it's nonsensical. If this woman was in compact with the devil and had all these powers and could affect all sorts of changes and influence of weather and seasons and the sickness of animals and people, where you think, well, why not cast a spell on your jailers or, turn into something and fly out through the window? But of course, that doesn't happen because we're constrained by reality. And then I suppose what we're actually seeing is an entrenched mindset being applied to individuals who, of course, weren't witches. So they didn't have any of these powers to protect themselves in any way.
Doug, you said that there was further confessions. After our first confessions, there were more over the weeks. What else did she confess to?
Well, she confessed to a great deal. So if we move forward onto her, this will be her third or fourth interrogation on the 2nd of August. She then confesses in detail to being an accomplice of Grissel Anderson and others who were burnt. Now, we know from separate records that Grissel Anderson was burnt in 1666, and she was probably one of eight Tory-born witches burnt in 1666. So this is 38 years before. So this gives us another clue about things in the area. So here we see Lily is confessing to have been a witch for at least 38 years. So, I mean, that's not a good sign. For example, we don't know if she was, when she was born, how old she was, or was she, if she was ever married, because we have nothing, no records about her other than the what we know from these trials. But that fact that in 1666 she mentions Grissel Anderson and calls it the second burning of witches in this place. Now, that's really important, because if that's the second burning, she must have been aware of a burning before that. And the only other burning before that we know of in that area in Torryburn was in 1644. So Lilius is actually saying that she remembers the witches of 1644. So this gives us another snippet of her age. And that's why I'm reasonably confident that she was in her, at least her 60s, possibly into her 70s. And at that interrogation again, this one on the 2nd of August, she talks there about, or gives us some clue of her condition, because she says that the devil bade her attend many meetings, but she couldn't attend for age and sickness. And she also mentions her eyesight fading. Although that could have been maltreatment, I'm 51 and my eyesight's appalling these days. That's why I keep screwing my face up on Zoom and things like that. So my feeling is we're getting a picture here of an elderly woman who, from her own words, if they are her own words, was suffering from age and sickness. She had fading eyesight, and of course she'd been treated terribly. So we're building a picture of the miserable last days of this poor woman's life.
I still can't get my head around what's in it for these women to have been witches. I just don't understand how it made their lives any better to go against the grain if they were, and I know they weren't witches, but this is the part that just seems so illogical to me. Why these women became witches, because really what did it give them in their lives? It just shows how ridiculous the whole thing is. I just keep sort of stalling at that point of what was in it for them, supposedly.
It's a very good point. Clearly very, very little. But we do get an answer in these minutes, because, of course, if you remember, one of her, on the occasion of her first interrogation, she actually said that the devil promised her many things. She specifically says that he, the devil, she calls him a villain, that promised her many good things when she engaged with him, but never gave her anything but misery and poverty. So if we believe the minutes, the deal was, you do my evil bidding and become one of my followers, and this is Satan, and in return, he will give you rewards. Now, life was hard and brutal for people of this order and this state and society at this period. Starvation was common, work was hard, disease was rife, life was unpredictable, there was none of the NHS and other social support systems that we know of today and so on. So, you know, when you put your grandmother in a home and things when she gets older, there was none of that kind of thing around then. So the idea we're getting from these cases is that the devil promised benefits, but unfortunately, as Lily is saying in this case, he promised everything and gave her nothing but poverty and misery.
Been there.
Yes. Now, these interrogations continue. As said, there are six detailed confessions, and they're all quite lengthy, so I'm only summarising the main points at which she confesses. But now we're into the fourth interrogation on the 19th of August, so we're, how far are we? We're 20 days into incarceration now. That's almost 3 weeks. So that's going to have been pretty tough time so far. And again, when interrogated, she confesses in detail to lots of local satanic gatherings. She confesses that she met with the devil over 100 times in her career as a witch, stretching back to before the 1660s. So she's been at it for a long time. And that's when she says that she would have gone more often, but she couldn't always attend when summoned because of age and sickness. And again, she repeated her previous accusations against local women Agnes Curry and Elspeth Williamson for being witches. And so she stuck to that part of the story, so the minutes would have us believe. And then on the 20th of August, she's paraded in church. So she's taken church and she's walked in and she's made to stand up in front of everybody to publicly renounce her actions and so on. Indeed, there's quite a detailed account of it. And if I can read just a tiny bit from the manuscript minutes, it says, Lily Azady appeared before the congregation on the Lord's Day, and being called up by the minister and asked if she was guilty of witchcraft, she confessed freely that she was, and had entered expressly into covenant with Satan and renounced her baptism, the devil putting one hand on her crown of her head and the other under the soles of her feet. And she gave over all to the devil that was betwixt his two hands, and she was come hither to confess her sins and to get her renounced baptism back again. And she also desired that all that had the power to pray for her, and it goes on and blah, blah, blah. So again, she's basically now being paraded as a dead man, dead woman walking type thing. And the idea is essentially that they want her to use her as an example to beg for forgiveness and so on pretty much before she's put to death. So, I mean, you can just imagine you can't imagine the terrible state and the injustice this poor woman was put to and bear thinking about.
At that stage, it would be clearly no point to her being wheeled before the congregation and then to say, actually, this is all lies. They're torturing me. That's why I said it. It would be beyond hope at that point. The best thing that she could hope for is to say, I've done wrong, please forgive me. And that's maybe why she would say something like that. Even if she did, I mean, we still only have these records, which are somewhat dubious that she ever did do such a thing. But if she did do, I'm wondering what her motivation would be for that. And presumably it would be to try and not be killed, to try and ask for forgiveness.
You would think so. But of course, the standard of justice then, confession to witchcraft wasn't ever going to produce an awful lot of sympathy. Basically, the most you could probably hope for would be a more speedy death and less suffering before the end came. So, you know, nobody just suddenly said, oh, she's sorry, well, let's let her off in this case and we'll put her on community service or something like that. You know, these things weren't an option. But you hint at the bizarre nature of thinking and so on. And it's quite incredible because at that same day when she was paraded in church, she was also, of course, interrogated afterwards as well. And crazy things happen. I mean, there's accusations and counter-accusations. So we've seen that Lilius has already accused Agnes Curry and Elspeth Williamson 3 weeks before. But now these two women, in turn, they accuse Bessie Callender, and she accuses Mary Wilson, and then she accuses Mary Carmichael and Linlithgow. And you can see how these witch hunts, kind of mushroom and so on and snowball. As soon as you're pointed out and fingered out as one of the guilty party, you kind of say, yeah, it wasn't just me, it was him, and you're trying to spread the blame, and from nowhere these things grow hugely. And absolutely bizarrely, a local lad, William Wilson, pipes up and he accuses Janet Glass of killing his mare, his horse, using witchcraft 24 years previously, back in 1680. So everybody's coming out with the woodwork, and anybody who ever lent somebody the lawnmower and never got it back suddenly is accusing their neighbour of witchcraft from years gone back. But
apparently, if they had a lawnmower in those days, it would definitely been witchcraft. I'm assuming that would be the only real witchcraft accusation at the time.
I do believe that the lawnmower is an invention of the 19th century. So yes, it would have been a scythe or a sickle back then. But the point being, everybody is bringing up old vendettas and suspicions and all sorts of things and using this as a great opportunity to point the finger at people they don't like and accuse them of witchcraft. So it just gets out of control. And the most crazy case happens later on when one individual, and this is bizarre because this isn't the 3rd of September, probably after Lily, well, not after Lily has died, a local lad, William Coss, states that on the Sabbath morning in 1704, it being moonlit, he had seen Bessie Meeklejohn, or the devil in her stead, in James Chalmers' bark, a bark's a boat, then lying at Leith. The session considering that the devil had appeared in her likeness, it was no proof against her. They judged it not necessary to regard the matter and thought that William Coase should not be troubled, appearing that he had not spoken from malice. So just to explain that, as these things, everybody's been pointing fingers and accusations are flying everywhere, this local lad suddenly pipes up that he had seen this woman on his boat at Leith, but it couldn't have been her because she was back in the village, so she must be a witch. And then the minister considered this and said, that's a good point. We don't think you're saying this out of malice, but no, we'll just ignore that allegation completely. And you think, well, why are you prepared to murder somebody on no evidence? And then when somebody is standing before you with cast iron, you know, witness evidence, you ignore that. And this is the bizarre thing about these cases, which tells us that there's an awful lot going on behind the scenes that we don't know and understand. There is a reason to get Lilius that we don't know about. And pretty much this is a staged, trumped up show trial just to remove her, basically.
I mean, I suppose the people in a small village, some people would be more protected than others and would have people intercede and say, you know, come on, this young lad's clearly talking nonsense. That's a good pal of, you know, somebody who's an elder in the church or something like that. You know, all these interrelationships may have had different views on it. It's quite interesting about the idea of seeing somebody being in two places at the one time and therefore she must be a witch, because that was something that was part of the Salem witch trials, where people confessed to being in a witch's coven and having met with the devil on a certain night, but witnesses said that she was asleep in her bed and they saw her asleep in her bed. And the way that was got round was, of course, you can look as if you're lying asleep in your bed, but actually you're out with the devil. And that's part of your magic, is to pretend to be asleep in your bed when actually you're out with the devil.
This is the problem when you go up before a judge who's decided you're guilty no matter what. You know, you can't defend yourself in such a case. No matter what evidence you provide for your innocence, anything that's, you know, going to get you off the hook will be thrown out and denied. And then the most ridiculous things will be supported. So basically, she was condemned from the day she got taken into custody. In fact, she was condemned even before that. You could see that they were looking for ways to pin witchcraft on poor Lilius, and they were successful. And the question really is not the surprise that they were successful, but what was it about this poor, lonely, older woman in a small village community which they decided a long time before that she was going down for witchcraft no matter what? And basically that's what happened. And all of these minutes are just, you know, to try and legitimise what was a completely unlegitimate process.
So you said that in the minutes, her death, as it were, isn't recorded. Is that right?
That's right. So we've got this case, of course, where she's been taken into custody in the very beginning of July. She's been interrogated throughout the whole of July. And she's confessed to all sorts. This localised witch hunt has just snowballed and so on. And then the very last we ever hear of Lilius is on the 29th of August. And there's a very sad but telling entry in the minutes for the 29th of August. And it says, some hours before her death, Lilius was interrogated again and declared that her accusations against Agnes Curry and Elspeth Williamson were as true as the gospel. And she added, and these are her own words, it is as true as the sun shines on the floor, and dim as my eyes are, I see that. And they're the very last words we have of Lilius alive. And then we never hear anything about her again. But from other sources, we know what happened to her after that date.
Do we know what she died of or how she died?
We don't. We have no knowledge whatsoever. There are two options or possibilities, or only two likely options. One, suicide, that unable to take the suffering and knowing what was coming her way, she took her own life. Or secondly, being an elderly woman exposed to horrendous treatment for a prolonged period of time in custody, she just passed away of maltreatment through natural causes. My own view is, personally, I think, given her weakness, her age, her failing health, that I think she died of maltreatment, but suicide is a possibility.
And what was the sort of prevailing view on suicide then, though? Was that not that it was a mortal sin, or is that just a Catholic thought?
No, it was very much the case that it was considered a sin by the Church of Scotland in this period too, and those who took their own life would be treated quite abominably. They wouldn't be buried in consecrated ground in the parish church and so on. They would be very often considered to have died out with God's grace, and they would very often actually be buried in the most bizarre of places. In inland communities, they would be under cairns and sort of areas set aside for suicide, because suicide was frighteningly common in early modern Scotland. So many women who fell pregnant out of wedlock, and so many other individuals who were destitute and so on, would frequently take their lives. And so we have countless records of suicide and suicide burial. But in coastal communities, it wasn't uncommon for these individuals to be buried in the intertidal zone, a sort of liminal place, not quite land, not quite sea, but reserved for the burial of those who died out with God's grace. And we've actually had over the last few years a number of human remains come to light off Kouros. And it seems likely that these are probably the burials of those who were buried there for some reason. We don't know whether they were suicides or for what other reason that they were denied burial in the local parish church. And what's happening is the sea is eroding them away, and then the bones are washing out. And every now and then I get a call to say we've got various human remains rolling about in the tidal area of Kouros and so on. So that's not uncommon.
If Lilius was moved, and this is maybe something we can discuss at more length, I wonder if there would be a way to find out, or if it's just there's no way of finding out what her death was actually caused by. Probably not, I suppose. But it would be interesting to know how she actually died. Because I think that is one of the... that's what I'd heard when we started initially talking about this, is that a lot of people seem to view that she'd committed suicide. I think it'd be interesting to know, you know, as another thing, as what you're saying about her, the times that she was in, about how poorly people that committed suicide or that killed themselves were viewed. It would be good to sort of reckon that for her as well, you know, that if she was to be moved to a Christian burial site and for that stain to be taken against her name as well, if you see what I mean, you know, to sort of completely exonerate her. Just seems like such a terrible group of injustice was done to her.
It does indeed. I think coming back to the question of suicide or death by maltreatment, we can never know. The evidence before us is not conclusive, but so it's for the individual to come to their own conclusion. But in my own mind, I'm confident that she died of maltreatment. This is a woman in her 60s, possibly her 70s. She's made it clear in her own words that she was old and infirm and had been for a number of years. Her eyes were dim and fading. And this is a woman whose the light and life is fading out of her. She's been interrogated. She knows death awaits her. She's all alone in the world. She's been treated in the most appalling and unimaginable way. And I just think she gave up on life, and that was the end of Lilius. Now, it's possible that she could have committed suicide, but as I said, there's no evidence and there's no way of knowing. Even though we have something of her remains and so on, they're not going to tell us, because if she did commit suicide, the only viable option she could have had would have been some form of strangulation. And there's no way, from what little we have left of her, of ever being clear about that. But of course, her burial, whilst suicides would have not been buried in the parish church and could have been buried in the intertidal zone, they wouldn't have had the absolute unique, bizarre revenant style of burial that we know Lilius had and what we'll be discussing soon. And so that tells her that her preeminent sin was, of course, witchcraft. And in the eyes of her contemporaries and the minister and the Kirk Session, the fact that she was a suicide, or might have been a suicide as well, was a minor consideration given the fact that she was a witch. So,
well, I think we're going to move on, in fact, next week, because we want to hear about the story of Lilith from when she was put in her grave. And we've spoken about her, the revenant aspect of that before. But when she was put in her grave, to the story which has continued on right up to the modern day with your involvement in finding her grave dug. So we look forward to speaking about that next week. But what it's worth, as we're talking about whether or not she died of maltreatment or she killed herself, I would say that they're both the same thing, because she was placed in such a situation that even if she did kill herself, it was as a result of her maltreatment that she would have placed herself in that situation. So I don't let anybody off by saying that she would have taken her own life. She'd only taken her own life in circumstances where she had been driven to it. That doesn't seem to me much of an act committed against herself. I think it was still committed against her by those who were accusing her of witchcraft.
Thanks for listening today. Please do share the petition. Please do join up with us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or even TikTok. I can't even believe I'm saying that last part. So please do get involved. Share. Tell people that don't use social media, because of course not everybody does, sensibly. The more people we have signing the petition, the greater chance we have of success, because obviously it would show that there's a public appetite for this to happen.
Can I also just add, Zoe, people have said to me that they've signed up and then they've checked and they haven't actually signed for whatever reason. I don't know whether or not they've not saved it or something, or not waited for the page to refresh. So it might be worthwhile just to check, if you think you've signed it, to go on and check, which you can do, check the list of names to make sure your name's on it, just to make sure it's got there. It's just I've had one or two instances where people haven't been able. The other thing is, someone wasn't able to sign it but wanted to sign it and sent me an email about it, and I forwarded it on to the petitions department, and the petitions department got some basic details from that person and they themselves were able to help them to sign on. So if there's anyone listening to this that thinks, oh, I don't know how to find the petition, how to sign on, etc., the petitions department at Parliament, which you can get by Googling the name, if you email them, they will just ask for the details that they need to put your name on it. So that's also another way, particularly if you are, as some of us are, a bit confounded by the internet as a generality. We look forward to bringing you more content from Doug next week in his final third instalment.
Perfect. Okay, thanks very much. Until then, toodle pip.
Toodle pip and goodbye.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of the Witches of Scotland podcast. It's not a podcast. That's a different thing. Sorry.
A podcast.
Podcast. Right.